This is a podcast from Grattan Institute, grattan.edu.au.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name's Annette Kimmett. I'm the office managing partner at Ernst & Young here in Melbourne, and I'm also the lead partner of our Victorian government and public sector practice. And I'd like to start this evening by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to their elders, both past and present. We are very pleased to be hosting this event this evening. As you know, Grattan Institute's higher education team recently released their report titled Graduate Winners, Assessing the Public and Private Benefits of Higher Education. And that report proposes a new approach to government's contribution to the cost of higher education. It's had lots of media attention, including today in the Financial Review. And it's my pleasure to be introducing the author of the report, Mr. Andrew Norton, Grattan Institute's Higher Education Program Director. Andrew has worked as a policy advisor to the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne and also as a research fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. He has written very widely on higher education. And joining Andrew this evening is the Vice-Chancellor of Victoria University, Professor Peter Dawkins. Peter became the third Vice-Chancellor and President of VU in January 2011, which followed 6 years in high-level leadership roles for the Victorian Government, including most recently as the Secretary of the Victorian Department of Education and Early Childhood Development, and before that 28 years in the university sector as an academic economist whose research interests included the economics of education. So in a discussion facilitated by Grattan Institute's communications manager, James Button, who was formerly a writer and editor at The Age, our guests this evening are going to explore the report's conclusions and recommendations as well as reactions to the report. So please join me in first welcoming James, who will more fulsomely introduce Peter and Andrew.
Thank you very much, Annette. And I'd like to start by thanking Ernst & Young for letting us use this wonderful room. And thank you all for coming. I'd also like to thank the Meyer Foundation, who are the supporters of our higher education program, and we're very grateful to them for enabling us to do this work. Before we start, I'll get Andrew and Peter to talk about Andrew's report for about half an hour, and then we'll have a question and answer session for about 25 minutes, and we'll be very keen to hear your questions to Andrew and Peter. I'd like to start by just setting a bit of the scene in higher education. As you all know, the last 30 to 40 years have been a time of great tumult in higher education and great change. Andrew and Peter tell me that when the Whitlam government lost office in 1975, there were between 200,000 and 300,000 higher education students in Australia. That figure is now 1.2 million, of which about 25% are international students. In the late 80s, the Hawke government decided that given the massive expansion in the system, the move from an elite higher education system to a mass system, it was no longer possible for the Commonwealth to fund 100% of this hugely growing system. It introduced the HEC scheme, which has been considered around the world as a world-leading scheme in a loan scheme that enables students to study for free at university, but to pay a proportion of their courses back over time once they go above a certain income threshold. Other countries, notably the United Kingdom, have followed that scheme. Since then, charges have been increased twice, and the system keeps growing. And so the dilemmas that face the Hawke government in the late 80s face education policymakers again. And in a sense, tonight we're going, one of the, without preempting what Andrew's going to say, one of the points that I think he wants to make is that it comes back to this question of, in a system that is growing so much, who should fund that system? And what should be the balance between public contribution and private contribution? Before the HEC scheme, it was 100% Commonwealth. Now it's 60-40, private 40, public 60. So that's the backdrop to Andrew's report. Andrew's team have also calculated that higher education costs the taxpayer about $6 billion a year, and that he has calculated that that could be reduced by $3 billion if students were to contribute more to the cost of their higher education. But rather than hear it from me, let me ask you, Andrew, to kick off tonight by telling us what is Graduate Winners about, and why have you written this report now? Why is this an opportune time to release such a report?
Thanks, James. Well, the prompt for this report was a funding review commissioned by the federal government that was published late last year, chaired by Jane Lomax-Smith, as a former South Australian education minister. And it effectively recommended that the federal government should pay to undergraduate students the expected future value of their public benefits, which they calculated was worth about 60% of the then average funding rate. We thought that their reasoning was not very strong, and we thought their numbers were a bit dubious. So the report was actually prompted by an investigation of that particular recommendations. However, it's really sort of blown into something much, much bigger, because we found that to criticise the base funding review, we actually had to have a framework of our own, an alternative framework. And the conclusion we reached was that we thought government should take a more hard-nosed approach to the issue of public benefits. And that is that tuition subsidies paid to universities on behalf of students should really aim at producing public benefits that would not otherwise exist. Our argument is that most of the public benefits produced by universities, including higher tax revenues from graduates and better civil society and these kinds of things, would be produced anyway, because the private returns to higher education are very, very high. So the framework we set up is really aimed at maximising the additional public benefits received by the general community.
So in a nutshell, Andrew, what you're saying is that graduates do very well out of higher education, and that the demand continues even when charges are increased, I think is a point in your report. And given how well, and you show in the report just numbers about, and you might tell us a few of those numbers, just over the course of a lifetime, how much benefit a graduate gets on average from higher education. Given that, then should the taxpayer, and particularly people who are not going to university, be subsidising people who are doing very well in a private sense from higher education? Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's really primarily a behavioural thing, that because the private benefits, both financial and non-financial, are quite high, subsidies don't necessarily have a big impact. So you have to think about what the subsidies actually do. And what they, in practice, do is slightly increase the financial attractiveness of going to university. So maybe instead of your course costing you $40,000, it costs you $15,000 or $20,000. So your net extra benefit from tuition subsidies is about $20,000 over your lifetime. But if you're already gaining hundreds of thousands of extra dollars, the argument we're making is that probably this doesn't make a big difference to your yes or no decision to go to university.
Peter, you've been in this sector a long time, and you read Andrew's report with a lot of interest. And I just wondered, when you read it, what your response was to the report?
So I think the report contains a lot of very interesting research and very interesting information that will help the discussion about the future of higher education. I think the major issue that's at the front of my mind in dealing with Andrew's fundamental recommendation, which is to substantially cut public funding to higher education, is that we're embarked at the moment in what's, I think, a very important period of the development of the Australian economy and the Australian education system, in which we've decided that what we need to do is substantially expand the number of people who go through tertiary education. And this is based on very strong evidence that the future growth of the economy depends heavily on having a highly skilled workforce, and that if you don't have a fairly high level of skill and a fairly high level of qualification in the 21st century, you're not going to fare very well in an economy if it grows and progresses in the way that we would like it to. So for economic reasons, for social reasons, because we don't want people to miss out on these future opportunities, we will need in the 21st century the majority of people to to achieve a fairly high level of tertiary education. And that means that we have to have a substantial expansion in tertiary education. We're embarked on it at the moment. We've got some targets that we may reach. The hardest one is about low socioeconomic students from low socioeconomic backgrounds. But those targets, when we reach them, we're going to have to keep growing them in order to have a successful Australian economy. And as we embarked on this experiment, to actually set about a process of reducing public spending on higher education by $2 or $3 billion, I think would put at risk this very important endeavour. Now, that's not to say that you wouldn't necessarily rearrange the way in which you do use the public funding. I think the way in which we use the public funding is an interesting question, whether we're using it in exactly the right way. But to actually cut it substantially when we really need to expand our skilled workforce would be, I think, a big risk. The second point I make is that the base funding review that that Andrew talked about says that at the moment funding per student is about 10% too low if we want to achieve the level of the quality of education that that we should be aspiring to for our students. And so again, cutting public funding substantially at a time when we need to increase funding per student. Now, you could arguably, of course, get that increased funding per student by charging higher fees to the students, and that would flow from Andrew's argument. But to get 10% higher funding, just to get the level of funding to what is considered to be appropriate per student to have the quality of education we need, would need a 25% increase in student fees without any cuts in public funding. So if you're going to cut public funding as well, you've then got to increase fees by more than 25%. And I think the other critical point to make in this debate is that the loan system that we have, the income contingent loan system, is already creaking under the level of debt that is being incurred. Andrew's quite right to say that students aren't being discouraged. They're not being discouraged from tertiary education because of the fees. One of the reasons is that the loan system is a very generous one, and students, some of them never pay back the loans, and some of them default on the loans. There's a big interest rate subsidy. So the more we keep loading more onto this loan system, which really is a very important part of the tertiary education environment that supports both an efficient and an equitable system, probably couldn't cope with the kind of expansion in fees that Andrew's talking about. So that would be the thrust of my concerns about his recommendations.
But aren't you and Andrew, in a sense, having an argument then about the end result of money that might be saved by changing the public-private mix, in the sense that if we accepted... You might accept Andrew's model, and let me not put words in your mouth, you might accept his model if the money was then put back into the system to encourage more students to get through their courses, perhaps to expand the system. Is that right?
I'm
trying to get to your objection particularly.
The particular model that that Andrew puts forward is, I think, very complicated. You might get Andrew to explain the model of how... The problem is that, if you compare the public benefit from any student's education with the private benefit, there's huge variety across the student population. So there's a ratio of public benefit to private benefit, and you can take an average and you can say, it's 50-50 or 60-40, but across the population of students, for some, the ratio of private benefit to public is much higher, for others it's much lower. And to try and extract from sort of each student the bit that they don't really need because they do the education anyway is a very complex task. Now, Andrew's got an idea about how he might approach that, not student by student, but course by course. So it would be you'd have a look at nursing first, and you'd look at teaching, you'd look at other courses, and then you'd have a go at saying, well, what's the average nurse like? But the problem is that there's a wide variety of people under each of these courses. Some of them don't end up doing the occupation that they've trained for. So I think the particular method that Andrew's proposing to cut the public funding is fraught with difficulty because it's very intricate. So I don't think he could persuade me that that was the right way to do it. But on the other hand, you know, as we expand, I think we need to expand public funding of higher education, not contract it. But we do need to use it to the benefit of the Australian economy and the Australian society. And so I do think your point that getting it as much as possible into expanding, getting the extra students in, particularly the low socioeconomic status students and the students that need the additional support, that's certainly the way I think we should take the public funding.
But let's be clear on this. Could students pay more if the money was used to be ploughed back into the system? Do you think there's capacity for students to pay more than they're paying now?
Well, the evidence so far has been with an income contingent loan system, as you raise student fees, it doesn't have a large deterrent effect. It probably has its biggest deterrent effect on the marginal student who's deciding, you know, at the margin whether they're going to go into tertiary education or not. And when you're trying to expand the numbers going in, the risk is you're going to contract the system rather than expand it. But yes, the ones that are clearly in and who get high benefits, they it seems would be willing to pay more. In Britain, they've just had a huge increase in fees. That has had a significant deterrent effect. Not huge, but significant. So it has reduced the number of students. And they've even cut the number of places for students in Britain. So this is going in exactly the reverse direction to what we want to go in Australia. But nonetheless, you know, a lot of students are still paying it, largely because of these income contingent loans, which means that they're getting an interest rate subsidy, and also some of them don't ever actually pay it all back.
Let's talk a bit more, Andrew, about public and private benefits, because Andrew's report really turns on this question of what is public benefit and what is private benefit. Now, Andrew, I didn't ask you to do this before we got here, but do you remember in the report we got some case studies about when a student might receive a tuition subsidy and when a student might not. I've found those case studies very useful in understanding the whole package that you're proposing. Could you talk a bit so people understand what we mean by public and private benefits and how that might play out in specific courses when deciding whether to provide it with a subsidy or not?
Okay, this is in the 10-page summary if people don't want to read the whole 90-page document. Federally, we've created two fictional people, Emma and David. So Emma is thinking about doing a law course. Course fees are $100,000, expected lifetime earnings, you know, $500,000.
And the rest.
And the rest. Just
annual.
Annual. Indeed. And so we think, well, say you give Emma $50,000 in recognition of the public benefits of her extra taxes and her volunteering and all these kinds of things. Will this increase the sum of total public benefits?
Let me stop you there. So there's an element of public benefits which is not the taxation, extra taxation. There's things like volunteering.
So the base funding review was very big on indicators which are described as a robust civil society. So greater volunteering, greater tolerance, greater civic engagement, which is drawing on a lot of American research which shows that graduates are more likely to do these things than non-graduates. So we just created this hypothetical number of the added public benefits. So maybe it's, you know, $100,000, but she was going to do this course anyway because her private benefits were so high. So effectively giving her $50,000 actually decreases the public's gain by $50,000 because that tuition subsidy could have been spent on other programs. So the public is actually worse off for paying this. The other example was someone called David. He wants to do a public health course. Careers in public health don't pay particularly well. Yet we said he could, you know, deliver big benefits in controlling infection and things like this. Because his public benefits were high, but his private benefits were low, David would rationally not do his course because he'd end up financially worse off than his counterfactual of just going into the labour force. So we argued a $50,000 subsidy to David would actually change his decision. he would do his course, and everyone would be better off as a result. So two, you know, artificial examples designed to illustrate a point that sometimes the subsidy adds to total benefits, public benefits, sometimes it detracts from them. And so the trick in policy is to try and subsidise the Davids without subsidising the Emmas. And we thought we could do this by targeting particular courses. Now, it's true that not everyone who does a course ends up in that particular career, but what we did in our analysis was we looked at what field of study someone did, not their career. So, for example, even though only about 50% of people with law degrees actually work in the legal profession, the overwhelming majority of people with law degrees do very well nevertheless. So, as a group, they are doing extremely well in the labour market. So a group that's very unlikely to be particularly concerned about higher charges.
And Peter, you've spoken a bit on this, but just very briefly, if I may, your concern here is that assessing this by course is unduly complex and difficult to...
Yes, I think, you know, I'd encourage people to read the report, but the sort of the process you go through to identify what to subsidise and how much to subsidise it requires a very complex set of information, it would be my judgment, and also quite a bit of assessment of fairness is one of the concepts that comes into it as well, and I think, you know, that could become quite subjective. So it's really trying to sort of micromanage the contribution of the public and the private course by course when there's such variety even within courses as well as between courses seems to me to be an interesting proposition that's been put forward in the paper, but I think it would need a lot more work to look feasible, and even then I can't see it working. But can I come to this question of the public benefits of education, because I do think that that sort of Andrew's argument doesn't actually rest on particularly on the size of the public benefits, because he argues that that because the private benefits are so large that that we ought to be extracting more funding out of the students, and they can therefore pay for some of the public benefit themselves. But I do think it is nonetheless important to have a discussion about what these public benefits are, because I think if you read the report, and maybe it's true of the base funding review as well, it probably focuses more on the less important public benefits and less really what are the big public benefits of higher education. So there is a literature on this, and Bruce Chapman, the architect of HECS, has had a go at estimating the size of the public benefits for Australia. And it does indeed include things like volunteering and civic engagement, and I think Andrew's analysis suggests that while those people who do higher education have a marginally higher degree of volunteering and civic engagement, really this isn't huge. But the bigger issue is really about the economic growth benefits from higher education. It's about technical change, it's about R&D, it's about the dynamics of the economy, and that goes back to that initial point that I was making, which is the reason why we're embarked on this expansion of higher education is to have a highly skilled and innovative workforce that generates technical change, economic growth, raises participation in the labour force. And there's a lot of research evidence that shows that as you raise the proportion of skilled workers in the workforce, it actually raises the productivity of the people that they work with as well. And so the ever-increasing degree of skill intensity and innovativeness in the workforce is really the key to our future economic success. So I think the public investment in education rests primarily on that and equity issues and the desire for everyone to have a good education, and increasingly over the 21st century a good education will include a tertiary education for most. But the economic argument about the public benefits revolves around the technical change, the participation in the labour force, the economic growth, not around just raising the amount of volunteering very much. So that's really at the core of the debate about the future of higher education.
What is the government's target, Andrew? I think it's that 40% of people in the 25 to
34-year-olds will have a degree by 2025.
But it's quite soon. It's only 13 years away. So that's a very ambitious target, isn't it?
And I don't think it is that ambitious, because we're already sitting around 35, okay. 36. So it's actually not that large a leap. The modelling of how to get there is extremely complex, but it's certainly conceivable that we will get there much earlier than 2025, given we've had a big expansion in the last few years, which is yet to show in the attainment.
What's your response to Peter's comment about the most important thing for Australia to thrive in a global economy is that we expand higher education and improve productivity across the workplace, as he says? In your view, is that the critical aim of higher education, to keep expanding along the lines that Peter suggests?
Certainly there's an extremely long-term trend towards more jobs requiring high skills, so that's definitely happening. On the other hand, there's generally not been a shortage of graduates. There are shortages in a number of occupations, particularly in health and over the last 6-7 years in engineering, but generally there has been a significant surplus of graduates relative to demand for them. So at any given time, about a quarter of graduates are working in jobs that don't actually require a degree. And this is actually, there are serious arguments saying this is actually a bit of a social bad, because what's happening is that employers start asking for degrees for jobs that don't actually need degrees, which pushes people who don't have degrees either into lower skilled jobs or out of the labour market entirely. So while acquiring a degree is almost always good for the graduate, it could have negative consequences for other people who are either forced out or forced to acquire a degree which they don't actually need to do the job.
Where do we stand? I want to ask both of you, where does Australia stand compared to comparable overseas countries, both in terms of the size of the higher education cohort and how much it's funded out of the private and public purse? I think it'd be interesting to discuss and how do other countries similar to us see the future? Do they think the goal is to keep expanding the systems along the lines you suggest, Peter, or are they taking a different approach? Perhaps, Andrew, if you start.
Well, there's been a common trend throughout the OECD, indeed in Asia, which is not yet in the OECD, to expand higher education. But the interesting thing is that there are extremely different funding models. That you've got the European model, which is typically almost entirely public subsidy, and you've got Australia, the UK now, the United States, Canada, Japan, South Korea, that have relatively high student charges. And what you see is this reflects the broader political and economic conditions of each country, that in high-tax countries, you tend to get a lot of government-funded services. In lower-tax countries, students often pay for health or education, which are fully publicly subsidised in Europe. But the actual differences in attainment are not that great, particularly after you left some of the difficulties in doing these OECD comparisons. They actually tend to be fairly similar throughout the world, throughout the developed world.
Peter, do you have thoughts on that?
So I think the thing to probably add to Andrew's analysis is about the contribution of the public and the private. I think you more or less made the point that we're relatively high on the private contribution. And that's one of the risks, of course, of going even higher, certainly of cutting the public contribution, because while we clearly need increased investment in tertiary education, relying solely on the private contribution, is very risky, and for reasons that I've said, but also on the international benchmarking. Other countries that are being successful in this endeavour are putting a bit more into the higher education sector than we are. Now, Britain, of course, has made a big, bold move to shift in the direction Andrew's talking about, and brought on really by an economic crisis. So I think, but if you have a look at what's happening there, then this is not a model to follow. So they've not only raised the prices, they've cut the places, and they're also trying to put more of the high achieving students into smaller numbers of universities, and it's going to, I think, cause a serious problem in terms of both the quality of the whole system, but also the rate at which it expands, which is what's needed in order to drive the economic growth.
I'm going to throw it open to questions in about 2 minutes, but I just want to end by asking you a quick question about funding, which is, Peter, first of all, where's the money going to come from? Of course, it's difficult, isn't it, to persuade the Commonwealth Government to commit the sort of funds that you think are necessary for the system. And I wonder, in that light, if you see in Andrew's report some possible solution for at least perhaps part of that funding, given the pressure on the public purse. And Andrew, to ask you, you probably would have bought a whole lot less trouble if you'd said, and all the money we save, we're going to plough back in higher education. that would have made for that would have made your life a lot easier in the last few weeks.
I would have got less coverage.
Yeah, yes. But it would have been, the easy move. Why did you not take the easy move on funding in this respect and say, well, you actually end up not saying where it should go. You just say it would save money to the public purse. But I'll start with you, Peter, and then over to you, Andrew.
Yeah, well, I think it has to be accepted that in the last few years there's been a significant increase in investment in higher education, and I think that's been good policy. There's been expansion of the number of places. There's been indexation of the funding to universities. So I think we are on a good track, and it's a matter of trying to sustain this increased investment, but. There's no doubt that that if you have a look at the federal and state government's budget positions and their avowed intentions to achieve budget surpluses and so on, and if you look at the current rate of economic growth, then there doesn't look to be huge amounts of additional public funding likely to be emerging for higher education over the next few years. So that does create a puzzle. And because we do need to keep this expansion going and we need to raise the quality. So I certainly wouldn't rule out additional contributions from the students. And I think that Andrew's report points out that there's a pretty high return to investment in education, and that when fees have been raised, students have not, in general, decided to reduce their participation very much. But that's for modest increases in fees with an income contingent loan system. As soon as you get to large increases in fees, even with an income contingent loan system, you can expect the system to start declining, particularly for those students that are the ones we really need to try and bring into the system. And then, as I said earlier, we are putting more and more pressure on this income contingent loan system through defaults on loans, through the interest rate subsidy. So what is an apparent reduction in public funding might not turn out to be as big because of the interest rate subsidy in the income contingent loan system. So the potential to raise fees substantially with our current loan system is quite limited. So if we do move in that direction, I think we have to move incrementally, and we have to do it in a way that doesn't jeopardise our attempts to raise participation in tertiary education, and we have to focus on particularly the low socioeconomic status students and the ones that need additional support. There's a correlation there. They're not all the same people. There are plenty of higher tier students who need additional support, plenty of lower tier students who are high achievers. But of course, in my university, Victoria University, we have quite a lot of low SES students. A lot of those do need additional support. And the current agenda of broadening tertiary education, both for social policy reasons and to raise the capacity of the economy, will mean that if we do get more public-private contributions from those who are getting high returns and can afford to pay it, then we need to make sure that it doesn't jeopardise that other group that I'm talking about.
Thank you, Peter. Andrew, just very quickly, because we're running out of time, why did you not plough the money back into the system?
Well, we did look at low SES students, and the history of this is that they seem to behave in pretty much the same way as people right across the SES spectrum. The reason their higher education participation is so low is that large numbers don't finish school, and of those who do, they are disproportionately in the lower scores. And so their higher education options are very limited. So you really need to improve those results to change their attainment levels. It's possible that they could be incentivised by scholarships or maybe something like that, but we thought on the evidence, probably not, and so that's not going to be a productive use of government funds. Look, we didn't do a full study of what are all the alternative spending options, but I was asked about this in interviews last week a lot, and I thought disability is one area where clearly the needs are vastly greater than the needs of higher education students and graduates. So it's not hard to think of areas where we could get greater public benefit for the money we're spending.
Thank you very much. I'm going to throw it open to questions now. Can I ask you to ask questions and not to make statements? I'm going to start with the gentleman in the front. There's a mic coming around, so if you could speak into the mic as it's being recorded. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Peter, I think your outfit is fantastic, how it matches the Ernst & Young banner. Just beautiful. I got a law degree from Melbourne, and I got a master's degree from Monash in the 70s, and I have three sons who have got university degrees, and they said to me their degrees were crap. Seriously. My question to the two of you is, do you think in the last 30 years, Peter and Andrew, that university education has got better or worse? Because I look at my iPhone, it's just amazing. It's just amazing. And yet, the evidence that I see, we're talking about money into education, do you think our education at university has got much better?
Peter, do you want to start? And then over to you, Andrew.
Well, I think you started off this evening by saying that we've been moving from an elite system towards a mass higher education system. And I think as you do that, the experience that our children have at university probably isn't the same as the experience that we had when we went to university, because we're talking about, you know, larger classes, for example. So I remember the tutorials that were relatively small, and we had intellectual debates and so on, and the staff-student ratios were low and so on. Or the staff-to-student was relatively high, I guess. So we have been expanding the higher education system. We're moving away from the idea of elite to mass higher education, and that does impose challenges. Now, whether that means that the quality of the system has deteriorated, I don't think it has. I think productivity has gone up, but the educational experience is different. And in fact, we've probably been expecting too much productivity increase, and that's why the base funding review said that that we need 10% more funding to get the quality of education that our students deserve. And Ross Millman, I recently attended a talk by Ross Millman, the Vice Chancellor of University of Technology Sydney, and he said when you benchmark Australian universities against universities overseas, we come out very well on our research performance. So Australian universities punch above their weight in research, but actually in terms of student satisfaction, we don't do quite so well. And that's because the funding that we get per student by international benchmarks is not as high, though we need this 10% more. And I think that we need to make sure if and when we get it, whether it be through the public purse or the private contribution, that we invest in improving the quality of the student experience. I think that's the number one focus that I've got at Victoria University in our strategic plan, is to raise the quality of the student experience. There's huge potential, as you say, with the new technologies, with blended learning. We can have a really rich experience for our students that isn't the same as the one that we had. And the future for our students is really wonderful in this new technological age and information age, but for universities to take full advantage of that, we do need this additional investment, I think.
I agree the experience is different, but I actually think that it has been improving. The evidence for this is really in the student satisfaction surveys. The first national one was done in 1993. It showed mass dissatisfaction. People were really unhappy with teaching. Around 1997, it started trending upwards and has very slowly and incrementally been improving since then. And I think that reflects increased teacher training for academics. So traditionally, most academics have a research degree. They're not trained in teaching. Their performance reviews now include, are you a good teacher rather than are you a good researcher? So things have been improving. On the other hand, I think they are still well behind other countries. Like, there's a few surveys, we've got the same question asked to Australians and American students. The Australians are a lot less satisfied than their American counterparts. The question is, would more money make a difference? Well, probably all other things being equal, it would, but there are cultural issues in the attitudes of Australian academics to teaching. They're ranked among the bottom in the world for preference for teaching relative to research. My concern about some of the funding increases is that I don't think it was true of VU, but certainly some of the other universities, they'll just cream it off for research and the student experience wouldn't change.
So I think the question probably was going back over a longer time frame than that, and that's why I was responding the way I did. But you're absolutely right that in the period that you're talking about, the focus on the quality of teaching has gone up, the measurement of student satisfaction has gone up, and the accountability of staff to improve the quality of teaching has gone up. So I think over that time period that you're talking about since the 1990s, I think in this more mass higher education system, the quality of teaching is going up, but there are significant challenges to achieve the level of student satisfaction that some of our international competitors achieve, given the pressure with on our budgets.
Yeah. Got a question in the front here, John. I will get the mic to you.
Despite being told not to make a statement, I'd like to begin with one. Andrew talks about public subsidy of education. Peter talks about public investment in education. That probably betrays where each is coming from. It might be more useful if it was public contribution to tertiary education. I think public subsidy is in fact a demeaning term, but that betrays my prejudices. I have a question, I think, for Peter, or for both actually, and then a specific one for Andrew. Are there data, is there evidence for financial considerations of making a lot of money? What percent driver is that in informing matriculants' choice of whether they're going to do law and be an eminent QC or do arts and be an underpaid teacher? And the second question for Andrew is, given that the school leaving age is 16, would you apply your same public subsidy argument to the last 2 years of secondary education? Because clearly there's an economic benefit from doing year 11 and 12. And what do you think the social implications of that would be?
Look, I think there's quite a lot of research evidence that students are pretty well informed about the returns to higher education and are influenced by the returns in deciding whether to do law or commerce or whatever. But they also take into account what they would consider to be the non-pecuniary advantages of different occupations. So, and courses. So I think creative arts, for example, gets quite a bit of coverage in Andrew's report as a subject. And there are students who are very determined to get into that sector because they just love it. And they're willing to put up with having lower income. They're not put off by it. But nonetheless, in general, students are well informed and the returns on average are an incentive, and that's good because we need more people to go into higher education. The returns are pretty high, and we need them to keep coming.
Could I answer that one as well? As part of this research, which wasn't actually published because we're still working on it, we had data on the median ATAR, which is the rank of the student, and we matched that against the lifetime earnings. We got a correlation of about 0.64, which is moderately strong. So a correlation of 1 would be a perfect relationship, and 0.64. That was significantly reduced by this factor of creative arts and humanities, where the typical ATAR of students doing these courses is reasonably good, but their lifetime earnings are quite low. And so that's reducing the overall correlation. But I think if you excluded the more non-vocational areas, it would probably be a pretty high correlation that we haven't done that yet.
Driven, not just by the demand, they're driven by the supply as well. So, yeah. So medicine would be the classic where we try and reduce the number of doctors through constraining the number of places, and that, of course, pushes up the price, both in terms of the rate of return and the ATAR. But,
For the last couple of years of school, look, I think this is an important point. When people ask me, why don't you apply this to school, you know, one of my answers has been that because schooling is a near universal experience, it doesn't have the same distributional implications, that even if we reach our 40% target for higher education attainment, that's obviously all 60% who don't. The last couple of years of school, I think it's still around 80% who complete school. Look, you could have income contingent loans, but I suppose my view is that 80% is pretty high. Don't necessarily want to create a loan scheme for the last 2 years of school. So I'm relatively relaxed about the costs of the last 2 years of school compared to the costs of the higher education system.
If university higher education went to 80%, would you become equally relaxed as a public good?
So I think the distributional questions, So I think the distributional questions would largely go away, and therefore there would still be issues about whether this was the optimal use of government funding, but I think the distributional argument would be irrelevant.
Can I take another question? Perhaps someone further down the room. The gentleman with his hand up there.
G'day, my name's Andrew Aston. The choice of degree as being the mechanism by which you allocate a subsidy or less of a subsidy, it seems to be in many ways a very blunt instrument. And I'm wondering, for the degrees that have a large number of different career options flowing out of, like arts, for instance, I'm just trying to get an understanding in my own mind, how would you introduce nuance into that so that it doesn't deter someone from pursuing a degree like arts and with the intention of going into a relatively low-income career that has a strong public benefit versus someone who might enter arts with a view to going on to a relatively high-income career? How would you nuance that in order to allow for those different aspirations?
As Peter said, it's very, very complex to do this at an individual level. Look, humanities and performing arts were really our two borderline areas where it was relatively difficult to demonstrate high public benefit on the measures we had, but it was fairly evident based on the enduring popularity of these courses and the high ATARs of the students going into them that there was significant private benefit, sort of revealed preference. People want to do these things. So our conclusion was that probably these were relatively weak areas for public subsidy simply because the private benefits were far more obvious than the public benefits.
The gentleman, I'll take the gentleman behind you first and then you. So, yes. Are you? I'm sorry, did I insult you?
My question's basically, we seem to be focusing on front-end loading the cost for the degrees and sending price signals to graduates that are looking to enter into degrees. What's wrong with potentially something like a resources super profits tax for the education sector and taxing people at the level of, you know, high earners that are achieving because of their degrees?
Well, there is a really interesting funding idea, which is basically that rather than the government subsidising, effectively superannuation funds buy equity in the future earnings of students. And so obviously they would lose on some students, but if they had a fixed percentage of future earnings, they would make enough money from the high income earners that they would more than cover the losses on the low income earners, which is sort of a private way of doing what you're suggesting.
Where was this floated?
So we find a few places, but a guy called Joseph Clark wrote an article for Policy Magazine a number of years ago.
Peter, what do you think? of a resource super profits
tax. That's a very interesting idea. Look, I think the progressive income tax system is partly doing the job, although we probably don't have the highest marginal tax rate anymore. But what happens with HECS is that the high income earners do pay more through both the income tax system and then through the through repaying the income contingent loan system. The ones that earn the highest incomes quickest will pay the most quickly, and those that don't get to the high incomes actually, some of them never repay their loans at all. So elements of this are kind of built into the existing system. Yeah.
Just wait for the mic. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Hayden Walsh. I'm a clinical academic. As you can probably tell from my accent, I come from a different place where going into medicine was really about the public good. It was obviously totally subsidised by government, but it was not, I think the motives of the kids going in was not driven by money. We live in a society where medicine, I think, is potentially a blight on the culture because it is heavily driven by money. That starts very early, it starts in school, and it's a social, it's a cultural thing, a bit like the cultural problems we have with academics in general. Medicine is a distortion because it's so driven by money, probably law is the same. So my question, I think, is, if that is true, I believe it is true, but if it is true, how do we use the public component of subsidising, say, medical education to drive a cultural change in the purpose of medicine as a public good, for example? I think you could say the same about law and other things. I mean, I could give you a few suggestions, but it seems to me by going down your road is that you're just going to reinforce this mercenary approach to a professional-centred culture rather than a patient social good-based culture.
Andrew, a quick response.
I'm not sure that the practice of medicine has been turned away from the patient. I'm not sure that the higher ed system can change this because we did have free education for a long time, and I sort of don't notice that specialists of that era charge particularly low fees. So I'm not sure that higher ed is the right mechanism for that kind of cultural change.
Peter, do you want to respond to me?
Oh, look, I must admit I'm mildly surprised by your assessment of the mercenary view about medicine. So it's actually have a daughter who was quite keen on the idea of doing medicine, and it actually in her case wasn't the mercenary thing. She was very keen on being a health professional and keen on the contribution to the health of the society. So. And I think it is certainly that kind of aspiration that we want to encourage in our medicine students. And I think that possibly comes from the way that medicine students should be selected into medicine programs. And my understanding is that has there's been a trend in that direction through interview processes and so on. So I wouldn't be quite as pessimistic, I don't think.
We've got a question right down the back. Probably the second last.
Hi, Catherine Howell. This is really a question for Andrew. Following up the theme of teaching quality, which we've touched on already, one of the tenets, it seems to me, of the move to the demand-driven system was that we might see more diversification in the sector. Now, one way to slice the public funding pie would be to divert some money away from research, which is typically cross-subsidised by teaching income, to see the emergence of perhaps teaching-intensive or even teaching-only institutions. What would be your response to that?
We've got an ongoing research project on that very topic, and the first thing we're doing is checking to make sure that the outcomes of students in the relatively low research institutions in Australia are okay. And if they pass that threshold, certainly we'll be looking at this. The couple of advantages of this, one is potentially it's cheaper for everyone. We're also concerned that the dominance of research in public universities in Australia is actually making teaching come off second best. And the only way to deal with this is actually institutionally, i.e. separating out some institutions, so they are teaching only and their mission is entirely about doing a better job for students.
I think the gentleman in the front has had his hand up for a while, and then this, I'm afraid, is the last question because we're nearly at 7 o'clock.
Thanks, John Osborne. My question is to you, Andrew. Milton Friedman once said of higher education funding that the reason that moves to increase fees are always so unsuccessful is because the political cabal that exists to protect them, that is, the income distribution from those people who don't go to university, the plumbers and carpenters and mechanics, to those middle-class people that seek the public benefit of funding and that do go to university. Do you think that is part of the cause of the reaction that you've received to your report so far?
Look, obviously, when you suggest that an interest group or people with a stake in something should get less money, most of them say no. We weren't naive. We weren't expecting that we'd release this report and universities would suddenly decide they didn't need any of this public money, and yes, what a brilliant idea. So clearly we realised that was going to be the case. But this is actually where I think think tanks are useful, because they're not actually beholden to interest groups, they're not beholden to the electoral cycle. Think tanks can actually say things that upset people and get away with it. And hopefully over time, people start to realise the merit of the argument.
Peter, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I'd agree that think tanks are useful, and this has been a good discussion. I think the thing that I can't be persuaded about in Andrew's argument is that the suggestion that we actually need to cut the amount of investment in tertiary education. So the kind of aspiration that I've got for the future of tertiary education brings the plumbers and the tradespeople more into a higher quality tertiary education system. So if we had a longer time to have a discussion, I think that by the middle of this century, we will have a reconceived tertiary education system where the distinctions between vocational education and higher education wouldn't be as stark, and where the vast majority of people do get a high level of educational investment, and that's why we need to keep expanding our investment in tertiary education to bring more and more people into that system.
Thank you all. Can I just conclude? We're at 7 o'clock. By thanking again Ernst & Young and Annette for hosting us tonight. We'd like to quickly thank Ben Weidman and James Savage from Grattan Institute, who worked with Andrew on this on his report. And I'd like to thank the Commonwealth and Victorian governments who are who have contributed an endowment that makes Grattan Institute possible, along with BHP. The University of Melbourne, which provides us terrific sport in kind, the Myer Foundation, as we've said, and as well our affiliates at Grattan, a series of companies who contribute every year to keep Grattan's doors open. Those companies are the National Australia Bank, Google, Stockland, Wesfarmers, Arup, Lendlease, the Origin Foundation, the Scanlon Foundation, Sinclair Knight, and Mertz and Urbis. There are drinks at the back of the room. We hope you stay around and perhaps Peter and Andrew will stick around for a bit as well to answer questions you haven't had a chance to ask. But above all, I'd like to thank Andrew Norton and Peter Dawkins for a terrific discussion. And thank you all.
This has been a podcast from Grattan Institute. Want to hear more? Check out our website, grattan.edu.au.